I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello and welcome to episode 114 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, March 29th. I'm your host, Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok. Today, as we await news of a vote in the Manhattan District Attorney's case against Donald Trump, we'll discuss breaking developments in a court battle between the Department of Justice and Peter Navarro about handing over presidential records to the Department of Justice, as well as a deadline for the Fulton County District Attorney to respond to Donald Trump's 51-page motion to quash the special purpose grand jury report and recuse Fani Willis from the entire case. Now, let's I guess, look at New York. I mean, we heard yesterday that there was a delay last week. And then yesterday we found out that, you know, today being Tuesday, as we're taping, that they brought in the onomatopoetically named David Pecker for a second round of questions. What do you think he said? And do you think, because my understanding is he left, the grand jury remained, he left. So whatever, it wasn't a function of they ran out of time, so he has to come back tomorrow. The reporting I've seen was that he was finished, he departed, and then the grand jury remained there for at least another hour.
Yeah, well, he's a crucial witness in the hush money payment case because he was part of that whole little group of hucksters that were, you know, catching and killing stories. You know, he was involved. Him and Keith Davidson and Michael Cohen were all involved in catching and killing the Karen McDougal story, the Stormy Daniels hush money payment. And then I think it was Shira Brasher, who got a $1.6 million payment from Elliot Broidy for an affair and to keep an abortion quiet. And it seemed like they were, and Keith Davidson would represent the person and Michael Cohen would represent the president. And it seemed like they had a little conspiracy going on to catch and kill these stories. And I remember reporting on this. It's been 5 years since I was talking about this, what I thought seemed to be a conspiracy of catch and kill to bury these stories. And you know, again, we don't know what the second crime is going to be that will bolster the first crime of falsifying business records to a felony from a misdemeanor. But David Pecker was in the room. And if you'll remember when Cohen was raided in April of 2018 and Barbara Jones, our favorite special master, was going through all of the stuff, working with the taint team, that there were taped recordings of Cohen and Davidson and talking about Pecker. And we do know that Pecker was in the room. So whatever, maybe when Trump brought in Robert Costello in last week, last Monday, this may be a rebuttal to tie up some loose ends from perhaps some of his trying to discredit Michael Cohen. That's the way that I kind of see it. I kind of see David Pecker coming in and playing cleanup. You know, the little guy who brushes in, you know, the big stone and curling, like that's his job today.
Yeah. And what, you know, the other thing that the delay does is it causes all the speculation and people, you know, some more credible than others and more informed than others. But there's an interesting piece written by Randall Eliason, and his concern was whether or not the Manhattan DA is going to be able to prove intent, saying, look, the statute requires proof of intent to defraud. And whatever you think about what happened, that the proof of that intent to defraud isn't there. You can, Trump could, he might have wanted to conceal an affair. He might have wanted to, or it might have been an improper campaign contribution in that, you know, that silence caused a political advantage for him. But at the end of the day, the intent to defraud as defined in New York state law doesn't exist. And so, you know, that's a fair point. But again, we don't have an indictment yet. We don't have anything to review. We're all speculating about what Bragg may or may not do. But it does, you know, the more time goes on, you know, for better or worse, a lot more credible people, it seems to me, are sort of speculating about the merits or lack of merits of the case.
Yeah, and you know, I've had a bee in my bonnet. Let's say it the nice way, about what Bragg has been doing. But again, I'm only looking at the surface. I didn't understand the deal he gave to Weisselberg for 100 days in jail when he had him dead to rights on a 15-year, you know, stint over at Rikers. I don't understand why they tossed the entire, and maybe they didn't, but I don't understand why, you know, Pomerantz and Dunn, that case, you know, they wanted to go big. Pomerantz wanted to go big. He wanted to do racketeering, little RICO and enterprise law up there in New York with everything. Trump Organization, Trump Foundation, Trump Steaks, Trump Wine, Trump University. And find like this massive sort of put together this massive case. And he said, and he's, you know, he put in his, we didn't have the resources. It was too big to get our hands around. But there are definitely pieces of that investigation, including some of the laws, both federal and state, that were probably violated that the New York Attorney General Tish James has put forth in her fraud claim, her civil $250 million claim against the Trump Organization that Trump was directly involved in. But again, we don't know the evidence. We don't know what he has. We don't know what he's going to charge here. But what I've talked to Randall Eliason a little bit, and let me see if I can explain this the best way possible. Right now, Trump is saying that these investigations are prosecutorial misconduct. They're trying to interfere in an election, right? That's what he's saying, that this investigation interferes in the election. And doesn't that prove his intent to cover up the hush money payment? I mean, if you go back and think about it, he covered that up. And now he's saying investigating it is obviously going to hurt me in the election. So doesn't that sort of show that he knows that that story getting out because he would be investigated would interfere in the 2016 election? I mean, I don't quite understand how he can square that circle.
Yeah, and I think that's what Eliason's trying to say, point to the intent to defraud as defined in New York state law is something other than that. And, I'd be the first to admit, you know, A, I'm not a lawyer. B, I'm not at all an expert on New York state law. But when he's saying, look, it is not, he may or may not have been trying to conceal his affair. It may or may not have been a campaign contribution, but neither of those hit the New York state intent to defraud as it's been interpreted by the courts. So I think, you know, even if it was a campaign contribution, even if he was trying to hide it, however that narrow definition of intent to defraud has been defined, that he sees that as being problematic. So again, I am also certain that Bragg and his very good prosecutors are well aware of the statutory limitations when it comes to the intent to defraud. And I cannot imagine a scenario where if it is hinging on whether or not this constitutes intent to defraud and they don't have additional evidence or additional facts to bring to bear, that they would choose to indict on something that shaky against anyone, let alone a former president. So while I take some of the, you know, I, Well, I take the concern with, you know, a great deal of credibility because Eliason's a smart guy. I also think the prosecutors are no dummies. So my hope is if they choose to move forward, everything that all of us are screaming about, hey, be careful, hey, I wish this wasn't going first, that they are not going to sort of like charge into it without having thought through that.
Yeah. So if Alvin Bragg indicts Donald, and I'm saying if, I am very interested to see what charges he brings, what crime he pairs with business records falsification to make it a felony, how he calculates the statute of limitations, because I know it's not close to being to expiring, but Trump will raise it as defense, so we'll see the counter arguments to that. We'll know how Bragg has calculated the statute of limitations and how he proves intent. If the crimes that we're thinking of are the ones that are going to be charged. Donald is in New York right now. They did not vote on Monday. Like you said, David Pecker left at about 3:30 with about, you know, over an hour for the grand jury to continue to deliberate. All 23 jurors were there, which is interesting. Only 16 are needed for a quorum. I feel like it was like just everybody be here just in case, you know. We may see a vote Wednesday. I do think that Bragg will bring it to a vote. I don't know whether the grand jury will return an indictment or not, but I don't think he would have brought Pecker in if he didn't intend to bring the vote to the grand jury. And we have to make it clear to everybody, it's not Bragg who's indicting Donald. It's people. It's the citizens, American citizens in a grand jury, everyday Americans that will be doing the indicting. And I think that that's going to be an important message that media and folks need to continue to push after, you know, this happens, and any indictment for that matter that might come down the pike from Fulton County. So we'll see what happens this week. This episode comes out Wednesday, and that's when the grand jury is set to meet again. So
yeah, we'll have our emergency update for the end of the week. And yeah, and sometimes, you know, again, this is in a federal context. Occasionally, if there's a borderline case, sometimes prosecutors will sort of gauge the temperature of the grand jury before they give them something to vote on. And if they get a bunch of like sort of raised eyebrows and stern looks from the grand jurors, they won't even give them a bill. Because if you don't get a true bill, if the grand jury doesn't return a true bill, in other words, if you give them the indictment and they don't vote to return a true bill, I mean, that's fucking god-awful.
And, hello, Andy,
you know,
McCabe,
and again, and our right? good, our mutual friend, Andy McCabe, that's when they were like going after him and had a grand jury in D.C. There's something nobody knows what happened in the grand jury. We know there was a grand jury, and we know that the case was so bad and so horrible that even though they brought on these witnesses in front of the grand jury never voted anything out. And so there was some reporting that the prosecutors knew that the case was such politically motivated crap that they kind of, after bringing some witnesses in, said, you know what, we couldn't get a true bill out of here if we tried. So, I think, again, the big caveat here is I am not at all an expert on how New York, you know, New York's DA grand jury works, if it's the same or not. But I think you're right. I mean, Bragg would not have gone this far if he did not have charges in mind and intention to do that. So I said this last week, I'm saying it again this week, I think we'll have a pretty decent sense this week whether or not New York's going to charge him.
Yes, and I think we can conclude that our friend Andy McCabe is not a ham sandwich. All right, let's go down to Georgia in Fulton County. Judge McBurney, who is presiding over the Fulton County DA's case, has issued a scheduling order for Fani Willis to respond to Donald Trump's 51-page motion. It's a short order. Here's what it says. On March 2023, former President Trump filed a motion that, if granted, would quash the final report of the special purpose grand jury, a body the Superior Court of Fulton County authorized to investigate possible criminal interference in the 2020 general election in Georgia. That kind of gives me a hint right there about how this might go. The motion also seeks the disqualification of the district attorney's office from any further investigation into or prosecution of such alleged interference. The district attorney's office is ordered to file a response to that motion no later than the 1st of May, 2023. That response beyond addressing the various contentions in the former president's motion, should also include an opinion on whether the motion requires a hearing for proper resolution. So ordered this 27th day of March, 2023. And, you know, I got to say, a couple things here stand out to me. The May 1st deadline is not a quick clip.
Yeah, but on the other hand, that does, you know, you can, Fannie Willis can do what she wants with that, right? On the one hand, if you want time to put together a very complete brief, cite everything out, you have that option to wait, a month and a week, right? Or she may be, there's nothing saying you may not file it until April 1st. May 1st.
Yeah.
So, I can see her if there's a very short, you know, sort of legal argument, or even if it's not short, if they can get to a place where they put it down and it feels, you know, complete and they're ready to go, they're under no obligation. I mean, it's no later than May 1st, not until on May 1st you must file. So, you know, I'm not sure. I would not be surprised to see some filing before then. And there's some, you know, you can speculation about whether or not timing given local Georgia politics makes a difference. There's some, you know, there was some reporting saying, look, that the legislative session in Georgia ends on Wednesday as we're listening, as this episode comes out. So perhaps, you know, there's some political advantage to Fannie Willis to wait until Wednesday to eliminate sort of legislative nonsense. But again, Wednesday is not May 1st at all. So, we'll see. You know, and then the other thing is, like, keep in mind, this order is coming from McBurney. This is the same judge, McBurney, who oversaw the special purpose grand jury. So this is the guy who was in charge of it, who was running it, who was ensuring that it complied with the law, who was ensuring that, you know, everything coming out of it, he supervised and oversaw.
Yeah, I think that's why he was like, the special purpose grand jury that was duly authorized, like, he almost kind of puts it right in the order, right? And we got to remember, this is totally separate from the regular grand jury, which she is now presenting evidence to. And so this filing doesn't, I don't think, have any bearing on whether she indicts. She can indict before she responds to this, to this particular motion, because it's a completely separate endeavor. It's a totally different work product. And, you know, you can still continue to litigate the special purpose grand jury even after the regular grand jury, I think, has done its duty. And I that, again, is just my opinion on this, but they seem very, very separate. And then I think the other funny thing that stood out to me is, you should address whether this motion requires a hearing. The way that I read that is, oh, and by the way, also tell me if we even need to fucking come into work for this. Like, do I need to shave my legs for this? I don't think so, but whatever, you know. It was reminiscent of, on the other side, when Eileen Cannon put out a minute order to Donald Trump saying, hey, you need to address jurisdiction, whether it's an anomalous or not. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, because an anomalous jurisdiction argument would have been a much stronger argument. But they didn't pick up on that cue and went forward with their regular jurisdiction arguments, which failed. I mean, they all would have failed, but they might have been able to delay a little bit longer if they had gone for anomalous jurisdiction in the Eileen Cannon order. But I feel like judges can sometimes drop hints. I'm getting really good at reading between the lines. And I think that, hey, and tell me if we need a hearing.
Yeah,
argue. I need to hear your arguments about a hearing. Normally, they just set a hearing schedule.
Right. And I think they want some of it to be able to, you know, there are a couple of things, I think, going on. One is to say, okay, government, you know, help. I think I have an idea, but, you know, you have a lot of resources. So go through and look at the law and come up with your theory and rationale. And maybe there's something there I haven't thought about that's compelling. And then the other thing is, you know, creating a record that will withstand any sort of appeal. So again, you know, not knowing what the process would be in the state of Georgia to appeal a special purpose grand jury, but the, you know, the judge making sure that he's asking all the parties to provide all their arguments so that there isn't some procedural misstep that, if he rules, as I expect he will, that this is a BS filing on the part of Trump, that it is so complete in the way that the process ran that there's
Good
no
process,
ability for
yeah.
anybody to poke a hole in it. But I, you know, I don't, my expectation is that Fannie Willis will say, no, we don't need to have a hearing. Here are all, you have all the facts you need. Here's our argument. Here's the reason we think that. And, you know, go ahead and issue an order. And to your point also, that's for the special purpose grand jury. That doesn't have anything to do or any bearing on the actual grand jury that would charge or bring charges.
Yeah. And we got to remember this due process stuff. You know, a lot of people get really frustrated when they're like, oh, an administrative stay was issued pending appeal. They heard it. They denied it. Another administrative stay was, issued from Clarence Thomas pending appeal to the Supreme Court. We got to hear it. And every time I post some news, somebody's like, he's just going to appeal it. And it's like, well, yeah, that's his right. It's his right to appeal it. And if we don't tie up all these loose ends now, they're going to come back and bite you in the ass during prosecution and trial and on appeal of any conviction, potential conviction. We're seeing the Department of Justice do this now with the utilization of obstructing an official proceeding, 18 U.S. Code 1512 C2, where 17 judges say that it's proper to charge these January 6th rioters with 1512 C2. And one judge, Judge Nichols, says, no, I don't like the word otherwise. It means that it has to be paper or, you know, I mean, it's just the weirdest thing. But now the DOJ is fighting this battle in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to ensure that going all the way up potentially to the Supreme Court, that everybody's interpreting the statute the same so that it can't be overturned if they say charge Donald Trump with obstructing an official proceeding or John Eastman or anybody higher up, and that they don't have to go out back and vacate convictions of January 6th folks for 1512 C2 based on that. So all of that stuff just takes so much time. But that is a criminal defendant's and a potential criminal defendant's right to go through that due process, hear all the arguments, tie up all the loose ends. And judges, that's how judges operate, so that when their ruling comes down, it is not challenged or it's not challengeable. It's sturdy. It's got a good foundation on it. It would be like building a house without a foundation if you didn't allow these arguments to play out the way that they need to. And I think down here back in Georgia, you know, Fani Willis is still investigating as far as we know. She took that report and she's not simply taking it at face value, which I think is important for the case because it's going to take away the argument that there was a rubber stamp in the regular grand jury and it was just based on this, you know, Emily Coors person's opinion or whatever. I can hear it in my head. But she wants to bring in Christina Bobb. That was a couple of weeks ago. And we don't know
well,
what
was
other-
good because it freed up Bobb to then go down this weekend to Waco, Texas to help cover Trump's little campaign launch event. But yeah,
oh,
sorry.
Good. Yeah, she had to get that done before she went down there. But, you know, there's just all these different procedural aspects of an investigation that have to be considered so that when you do indict, if you do bring a case, that it is on a very solid footing because all due process has been exhausted and no rights have been violated of any potential criminal defendant. So that's what we're seeing. And I like how Fani Willis responded because everyone's like, you said imminent on January 24th. It's March. It's almost April. And she said, look, imminent in legal terms, not imminent in reporter's terms. And you know, it's very, I said imminent meant like 3 weeks in government speak. I was way short, you know, which just goes to prove the point that these things take a lot of time. Also, the Senate and the House down there in Georgia passed that bill to have a prosecutorial oversight commission. And that is expected to go to Governor Kemp's desk and he may sign it into law. And I think that might be another reason why she, you know, if she's waiting, if she's not still investigating, to wait until that legislative session ends. But again, this is all tea leaf reading. You know, this is all just sort of speculation. And we will see, you know, I've always said, like, we will see when we will see. But, you know, it's always, for me, it's the news about the investigation as it happens is just as important and has to be reported.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And it's better. You have to be complete in a circumstance like this because, you know, it's an extraordinarily high profile case. I mean, people wondering like, well, why do they want to talk to Bob if Bob is going down there and covering Trump events? Well, you know, Bob, quite likely there will be defense witnesses as well as prosecution witnesses. And so one of the things you want to do as a prosecutor, as an investigator, is get people, you know, who may well be on Trump's side. But Bob, who was certainly present, it appears, at multiple phone calls, not only to Raffensperger, group to second call as well, but to get them on the record, knowing exactly what they're going to say, so that whether, you know, if you bring charges against Trump, if Trump's team then calls Bob as a witness, you want to already know what the answers are going to be to whatever the defense might try and ask him. So that's part of the reason you get, I think there's new information about Bob's presence in some phone calls. And B, you need to get all that in the record, because what you don't want to have happen is you rush in, you bring charges because you think you have strong witnesses, and then you get to a point where you're approaching trial and you've got, you know, defense witnesses being called, and there are questions that are going to be asked that you haven't already asked, and you have no idea what, or you only suspect what the answer is going to be. So, you know, I think it's completely appropriate and frankly normal to be seeing this sort of like just tying up loose ends on this path. Nothing in the law in prosecuting cases is fast. And I think as much as all of us would like some measure of like, you know, it's been 2 years or however long, why are we still waiting? We're waiting because our system is set up to be very deliberate. And I think it's a good thing, because for anybody who's arguing hurry up, do you want to be able to make those same hurry up arguments if Trump is reelected and you have Alina Habba as the Attorney General of the United States of America? Or do you want the same procedural, get it right, protect and make sure we're doing this appropriately sort of measures in place? So, I think it'll come. And, you know, within the next couple of weeks, probably not. But, you know, by the summertime, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And we also have to make sure that any other testimony Bob has given to any other agency, which she has, doesn't conflict with the testimony that you're going to present, because that makes that can impeach the witness. We saw that happen with Jim Baker in the Sussman case. He told Congress one thing, the inspector general another thing, and the grand jury another thing. And that made him a completely useless witness. And the only witness that John Durham had, one of the main reasons outside of materiality that whole case was wasn't dismissed, he was acquitted.
Right. And also to that point, and it also, you know, the fact that there in some cases it looks like John Durham didn't know about some of the things that were in the government's possession, that he only learned very late in the process, that Horowitz had, you know, some texts or information off of phones from Jim Baker and others, points to the reason why you don't rush into things. Because when you rush into things, you have a sloppy case that falls apart and you look terrible. And that's what Durham did, not once but twice. So, you know, again, it's we can whenever that his report, whenever he emerges from the basement of the Department of Justice in 2027, we can have a special session to break down, you know, the 12 years of his efforts and what became.
I could do a whole show of just laughing at Durham. like you said, these things are important, and that's why. You know, even that whole thing where I was the whole concept of asking for a stay and getting an administrative stay pending an appeal where they ask for a more permanent stay or grant another stay. All of that stuff is very important to the process. It does take a long time. And that is kind of, you know, what the Trump side is latching onto is the delay. And speaking of stays, we have some information about the Peter Navarro case that we've been covering on Cleanup on L45 for a while now, but we got to take a quick break before we get to it. So stick around, everybody. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Welcome back. Time to take a look at something you've been covering on the show, Allison, for a long, long time. This is Department of Justice's lawsuit trying to retrieve presidential records from Peter Navarro in the form of emails that he sent using a private Proton Mail account. Now, this is nothing new. I'm surprised, you know, like having preached, you know, things take time. Nevertheless, that we're at the end of March 2023, and the United States government still does not have from Peter Navarro the presidential records that he generated while a employee of the United States government at the White House. It's surprising to me that we're here, but yet we are. And I, you know, kind of, if, I don't know if you want to, you probably know the backstory a little in better detail than I do, if we want to sort of like run through how we got to where we are right now.
Yeah, sure. And also he's just refusing to hand shit over, right? So he had a Proton Mail personal email account. Interesting. Personal email account used for government work.
Yeah.
And
lock her
this
up,
is
right?
when he was, this is when he, do you know anything about anybody?
It's funny. I think you're not supposed to do that if memory serves correctly, but that's just me. Jared told him over WhatsApp and his, you know, their three-way chats with MBS that it was fine to use Proton Mail, I'm sure. So that's why he did it.
Oh, totally. So he was the COVID advisor, and there's a bunch of emails he used his private account to do some, government work over, talking about ivermectin, and we got to push this, and we got to push ivermectin and bleach in the veins. I don't know. It's all bad. We've gone over some of these emails. It's all just ridiculous BS. But regardless of the content of the emails, they are presidential records, and the Department of Justice said we need them back and sued him. And he said, no, they're not. I'm a special guy. I don't need to hand over those.
I'm asserting white male privilege. Isn't that a thing?
Right? I have some sort of privilege. Now, Navarro was ordered to hand over the emails, which pertained to his time as the COVID advisor. And then Navarro filed a motion for a stay. Now that he's been ordered, on the very last day that he could, he filed a motion for a stay, arguing that he could win on the merits. And his merits are statutory ambiguity, saying the Presidential Records Act it's murky, and a lack of precedent. Hey, there's never been another COVID advisor wanting ivermectin that sent emails on Proton Mail that you want back. Like precedent. He added the argument that D.C. is not a state, so its laws cannot be applied by the D.C. District Court. a federal court? I don't even understand that argument.
Yeah, dramatic foreshadowing. Let's wait and see how that works out for him.
Dun, dun, dun. He also argued he would be irreparably harmed if he has to give his emails back, or turn them over, I should say, for the first time, not give them back. Department of Justice argues that's impossible because Navarro has no possessory rights. He doesn't own them, and he was obligated to incorporate them into the White House records system within 20 days of creation, which he failed to do. Quote, defendant cannot be irreparably harmed by producing documents he has no right to possess in the first place. That's like if I stole a bunch of money from the 7-Eleven and I got in trouble and had to give the money back. And I said, but I'll be irreparably harmed if I give this money back. I won't be able to pay rent if I give this money back. It's not your money. You can't be irreparably harmed by having to give that back. Now, DOJ argues The public interest weighs heavily in favor of the U.S. having a complete record of every presidential administration. They also argue that the law is clear. They go through this, you know, they've already argued all these points in having to have him turn him over. And based on those arguments, the DOJ contends that Navarro meets none of the factors. There are, you know, certain factors you have to meet in order to get a stay. And he has fallen extremely short. He won't win on the merits. His merits are stupid. He's stupid and his face is stupid. He's not going to win. And his arguments are terrible. And here's why. They spell it out wonderfully in this filing. It's just, it's only 9 pages. It didn't take long to shut this shit down. And that was the latest that we had, right? That was the latest info we had on this case.
Yeah, yeah. And until now, the breaking news, yes. on Tuesday morning, just after 9 o'clock, you know, the table is set, right? You have the place setting from Peter Navarro and the place setting from the Department of Justice and the typical basement cosplay law that seems to afflict the entire Trump kingdom on the one hand, and a very logical, well-reasoned, completely makes common sense place setting on the part of the Department of Justice in the United States of America. And so this morning, just probably less than an hour ago, Judge Kolar Kotelly, who is nobody's dummy, issued a 13-page order ruling against Navarro. Now, I'll give you some snippets that I just pulled out literally right before we went on the air, but the too long didn't read version is essentially Willy Wonka saying, "You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir." So it starts out page one.
I said good day.
Page one, not even off the little pleasantries at the beginning of the ruling. Page one starts after the first paragraph or so. "If this is a case of first impression, as he contends in seeking a stay pending appeal, it is only because, unlike his many thousands of public servant predecessors, Dr. Navarro is apparently the first to steadfastly refuse to comply with the Act's requirements and, in excuse, assert a series of meritless arguments to evade his statutory responsibilities. At its heart, Dr. Navarro's motion is little more than a rehashing of the same arguments the court has previously rejected on the merits. Defendant's newfound concerns for federalism fare no better than his earlier arguments. Because he has not shown a likelihood of success on the merits, irreparable harm certain to occur absent interlocutory relief, or a weighty interest in retaining property that he concedes does not belong to him, no stay shall issue." So, you know, if you could put down the filing, you know, at the beginning of the second page and be done. But it gets better. And, you know, some couple of snippets after that. "This is not a case of first impression, nor is it the first whiff of quote-unquote tyranny for the United States to seek the return of presidential records, and only presidential records, that are, by law, its property, not the private property of Dr. Navarro, as he now seeks to contend in framing his appeal. It is not a case of first impression that the United States seeks recourse through the courts. It is not a case of first impression that a court may issue a writ of replevin in favor of the United States. It is not a case of first impression that the courts utilize federal rule of civil procedure to avail themselves of writs of replevin or similar remedies under the laws of a foreign state, e.g. Bank of America, N.A. versus Juan Sam Yee," and a citation.
Yeah, see a million cases. Yeah. See a million different things.
And turning to D.C., quote, "that the District of Columbia is not a state but a quote-unquote federal district, as Dr. Navarro repeatedly declaims, is a distinction without a difference for these purposes, and also a false legal premise rejected by a half century of Supreme Court and circuit precedent instructing the federal courts to treat District of Columbia law as state law." So, and then just one more juicy tidbit, and we can have takeaways after that. "And while it is indeed self-evident that once produced, the documents, which belong to the government, are no longer kept inviolate in Dr. Navarro's possession, given that he has made no showing whatsoever that he has a right against self-incrimination from their production, he cannot demonstrate an irreparable injury." So, you know, just piece by piece, argument by argument, the court went through and said, "No, no, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is incorrect." And it isn't I found that, well, you know, there's some in this balancing test, some mitigating factors, some aggravating factors, and I have to say, no, it just tore apart every argument that he made. So I think, you know, hopefully, again, this is denying a stay. He can still appeal it, but his production of it is not at least going to be stayed by the district court. So, you know, it's whether you want to call it salty or tart, whatever adjective flavor you like coming from a court's writing. This is not a very unsparing, I would say.
Yeah, and let's talk about his self-incrimination thing, right? Because this was a very funny part of the entire case to me. He said, hey, if I hand over those records, that proves I violated the Presidential Records Act, which means I could be charged. And so he tried to argue that producing these presidential records would violate his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, even though documents don't really pertain. And the fact that the government just didn't come out and fucking charge him, they sued him, you know, indicates that they aren't intending to charge him. Now, I don't know if that's the case. He might hand them over and the government might go, oh, yep, these are presidential records. We should charge him. But they've had access to see all these records throughout this entire process. They would have charged him if they had enough, you know, evidence to do so. They just want their shit back. This is different from, you know, the Donald Trump classified documents thing. You know, otherwise the DOJ would have sued Donald Trump to get all those documents back instead of criminally investigating him and executing a search warrant, right? That's not happening here. And so it's a very weird argument, and I'm trying to figure out what it is. Is it really his concern about self-incrimination, or does he just not want people to see his dumbass emails?
Probably both. I mean, look, and to the point of, like, you know, the court made multiple requests. They cited in this order and in the previous orders coming out saying, look, you are claiming this harm under the Fifth Amendment. Show us something. Make a showing that we can decide that, oh, yes, in fact, that is accurate, and you're not required to turn it over. So he keeps saying it is and asserting it without any sort of fact to buttress that assertion. And the court has repeatedly said, all right, you're asserting this, show us. Give the court some sort of proof or evidence that this, in fact, would occur, and did that on multiple times to the point of, like, you know, no district court wants to be overruled if it gets appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals, but saying, look, show us. And in the absence of any sort of response with fact to that request, the court's saying, look, we've asked, you failed to produce it, therefore we're going to deny it. And so, you know, one, I think it points to, if there was something there that was truly egregious, you would think that he would have produced it in a way to prevent it from being turned over. But it's not, you know, I don't know if that's ultimately a winning argument that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, a presidential record is a presidential record, and whether or not you incriminate yourself, I mean, this isn't some testimonial issue where you're being compelled to, you know, answer something or provide something. It's the government, you know, to your point, it's, you know, some robber sitting on stolen bank money saying, well, this, you know, it's not theirs lawfully to begin with. So, you know, we'll see. And I guess I don't know how fast, absent, what will be interesting is when and if he turns it over, since the stay hasn't been granted, how quickly that takes effect, and how quickly, if he doesn't turn the material over, the government would move the court to say, you know, Your Honor, it's been 1 day, 5 days a week, I don't know how long he hasn't produced it. You know, we're moving for relief to cause that to happen.
Yeah, and he didn't make any arguments like Jaffe made in the Sussman case, where I have a sword of Damocles hanging over my head. Durham says, keeps saying he's going to charge me, and I think he's using that to blackmail me into, you know, testifying, etc. There's no argument from Navarro like, hey, I've got the sword of Damocles hanging over. If I hand these over, the government's going to do this. So he's never come around and said, I will hand these over gladly if you give me an assurance that I won't be indicted. Or let's talk about immunity from indictment in this particular case. There's been no discussion about anything like that. He just says, you're violating my Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination without a showing, like you said, and without that even hint of an argument. It totally falls apart under scrutiny, under legal scrutiny.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see what he turns over. I mean, some question in my mind about what he still has in his possession, what he might have, you know, not that he'd ever say he destroyed it, but what he got rid of, whether or not he knows, you know, does the government have through other, like, you know, whoever he sent these proton mails to, does the government have a general idea of like, all right, we know because we've talked to all these other people or called him in front of the grand jury that he sent, I'm making this up, you know, 150 emails from his proton account. And then if he finally produces this and he turns over 72 emails, the government's going to know that that wasn't a complete production because they've gotten missing emails from other parties. So, and who knows what's in there? I mean,
maybe that's why he didn't argue it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we can. We'll get, you know, set the timer now because in, you know, what time does Jesse Waters or Tucker come on? Because he'll inevitably show up to complain about, you know, something goofy and crazy in about, I guess, what, 7 hours from now.
Yeah, because if you have to, you know, if you have to argue that it will irreparably harm me because you'll indict me because I shredded half of these, you know, then, then you know, well, hey, man, I mean, I could see why you probably wouldn't want to make an argument and argue about the other crimes you committed that you could be indicted for, you know, in the production of these documents, because then you just are like, hey, these are my extra crimes. Come and check them out. I don't know. I just find it that I feel like if the DOJ knows about those extra things, they're not waiting for proof after production from a civil suit to nab him. But who knows? I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, again, there would be, even if there was something clearly when he, if he produces and or if certainly if he fails to produce something the DOJ knew he did, being able to take that and then move to the step of saying, okay, we know he had it and he willfully destroyed it because he didn't want to turn it over is a big step. You need some sort of information indicating that obstruction was going on. And then even if you had indications of that, to sort of put all that together and figure out, okay, does this, looks like it violates the law. What evidence do we have? Let's, you know, brief that. How do we want to time that or leverage that against him? Because, you know, certainly like many other people you're looking for, he's not as critical as like Mark Meadows. But if you found all these things, at some point you want to look at between the Eastmans and the Jeffrey Clarks and the Navarros and the Meadows to find somebody who is criminally culpable that the government can say, here's your choice, cooperate with us and we'll, you know, give you a deal, or you're going to jail for a pretty long time. And, you know, Peter Navarro may not be the top of that list of people, but he certainly would be if I'm looking for a cooperator in that group of people. Now he's, from what I've seen of his temperament, I don't know if he's a very viable cooperator.
Weird.
Let's say
he's
it that
really
way.
Weird.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see. But I mean, clearly, I think from what we've seen, it needs to be, you know, at a minimum for contempt, needs to be in jail for a little bit, in my opinion.
Yeah, I that would be good. But you know, we'll see how this all plays out. And I mean, I could just see it. Like, hey, how about you just promise me you won't indict me when I turn everything over. And then DOJ's like, why would we indict you after you turn everything over?
We're a little bit, that mile marker was a good, you know, 15 minutes behind us, buddy. So that's,
yeah, totally. Well, I'm glad that decision came down, and I enjoy the spiciness of it. It was pretty funny. We'll see if there's a response. We'll see what happens in this case. But I'm assuming at the end of that order, you have it, right? He was ordered to hand everything over again.
Right. Yeah. And it's like the stay has not been granted. So that's period, full stop. He doesn't now, you know, can he appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals for a stay? Yeah. Possibly. But I just don't see, you know, they would have to. It seems like a very straightforward order, and you know, there's no right that they have to take it up. So I can see, you know, at this point he has to get it over. The stay is not being granted, and
the next steps, you're right, would be ask for an emergency stay pending appeal from the DC District or Circuit Court of Appeals. And if they turn it down, you can ask the SCOTUS for an emergency administrative stay. I don't think they're gonna, I think they're gonna laugh this one off, but you know, we'll see.
Right, agreed. So,
all right. Well, that's the show. It's been lovely.
Yeah.
We will see what happens today, if you're listening to this show on Wednesday, down there in the Manhattan District Attorney's grand jury. I'm going to keep my eyes on a couple of really great accounts: Robert Costa, Kyle Cheney, Garrett Hake. They've been telling us how many jurors show up, that guy looks an awful lot like David Pecker, you know, that's kind of the reporting that we've been getting. And so they're down there on the ground and we will see if there's a vote tomorrow. And then, hey, if not, we'll just keep reporting the news as it happens. We'll just go from there.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. I've been Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok. Have a great week, everyone.
Yep, have a great week. We'll see you next time on Clean Up on Aisle 45. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry...
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.